why the righteous suffer. We don't have an answer. And therefore, it's non-productive to speculate. If we don't have an answer beyond our understanding, we're wasting our time speculating. What a halakhic approach is that everything leads to, in halakha, everything leads to behavior. Right? So that the question is, what can we learn and grow from the suffering? Not why did God allow it to happen? We're not going to get anywhere with that question. So, and then he discusses Eov. And Eov is an interesting sefer, because on one hand, the beginning of the sefer says that Eov was a tzaddik, right? And he did everything right. So then the question is, so what does he have to grow? He did everything right. And the end of the sefer is that Eov realizes that he's missing a very important dimension. That even though he didn't do any chatayim, and he gave charity, and he did everything he was supposed to do, he lacked what we call empathy, and what Torah calls chesed, usually translates loving kindness. Right? He didn't care enough about what's happening around him. He only took care of what he had to take care of, what was under his responsibility. Didn't have that broader notion of caring. And the lesson he learns in the end of the sefer Eov is that he prays for his friends, even though his friends, the three of them at least, the first three, told him it's all your fault. Since God is just, then you must have sinned. It must be your fault. And even though we'd probably say it's not very good friends, you know, they helped him out by telling him he's wrong, it's all his fault. Nevertheless, he prays for them. Right? He shows concern, he broadens his concern. The problem that remains is that works out when you talk about Eov. But if you're going to say every time there's suffering, we have to learn to better ourselves, it's a bit vague. We should always better ourselves. Right? Should we give more tzedakah? Should we stop saying Lashon Hara? There are a lot of good things. A lot of good things we can do, right? What's specific? So the Rav doesn't answer the question directly, but he does put it in the following context. Remember, Kol Dodi Dofek was originally a talk given in 1956. In 1956, the consequences of the Holocaust were still being felt. Right? The survivors after the war, many of them were still in the DP camps for 2-3 years, and they came out with very little, and they were still struggling to make a go of it. And the state of Israel had been established, but it was far from secure. Right? We think of Israel of today, right, with the most powerful army in the Middle East, and but think of Israel as it was. Hard for you to think of that. But imagine it in the mid-1950s, right? Struggling, they had just taken in a massive aliyah from North Africa of Sephardic Jews. Actually, the numbers who came after the establishment of the state in the early 50s, most of them being pushed out by the Arab countries, was at least as many as there had been people before them. Israel more than doubled its population of people who came taking very little with them, and very little with them, and there was tremendous cultural differences. which have not even been resolved, if you follow Israeli politics, even today, and this is a lot of years later, right? Ashkenazim, Sfaradim, it's still a big issue. Okay. So the Rav is going to see the situation as pointing in a direction of very specific things that should be enhanced as a response to this particular suffering. It's not just people suffer, they should get better, they should do mitzvos, but they should analyze what happened and see what could be improved vis-a-vis the world that emerged after the suffering. Right? Then, in this context as well, the Rav is going to introduce a totally new element. The new element is where the name of the book, Sefer, comes from, is Shir HaShirim, right? And if you recall the story of Shir HaShirim, what sticks out in Shir HaShirim is that the beloved, the two, always misconnect, right? It's not the happiest of works, right? The beloved knocks on the door, and the beloved woman hesitates, do I look right, do I have to do this, do I do that? And she finally brings up, she goes to the door, and the dough is gone, right? And that's a recurrent part of the book, right? A recurrent part of the theme of that the relationship doesn't get consummated because they miss each other. Right? Then they miss each other. So this is going to be the theme of the rest of the book, of this book, that God is hinting to us, and the question, are we going to miss, like the woman in Shir HaShirim, are we going to miss the sign? Are we going to delay and not be there when it's necessary? And that's Kol Dodi Dofek is taken from Shir HaShirim. And dofek literally means to knock on the door, right? Kol Dodi Dofek, Hashem is knocking, and the question is, are we going to respond appropriately? All right, we're going to get to that in later chapters. So let's go back and go into chapter 3. I'm going to move quickly because it's a lot of words, and I want to cover, I don't want to spend the whole year not finishing again. Okay. We are two living in troubled times, in days of anger and distress. Remember, it's 1956. Things haven't gotten great yet. Assume it's gotten great. We have been afflicted with violent pogroms and have become accustomed to suffering. In the past 15 years, we have undergone tortuous ordeals that are unparalleled in thousands of years of disaster, degradation, destruction, primarily from 41 to 45. The Holocaust. This chapter of suffering did not end with the establishment of the State of Israel. To this day, the state is still in a condition of crisis and danger, and we all fear for its future. The Rav is very careful here. Clearly, on one hand, the establishment of the State of Israel is a tremendous source of hope and positivity after the Holocaust. But the Rav does not want to be caught in saying it's the solution, right, to the Holocaust. So the Rav is talking 1956. 1956, as the state itself is not even secure yet. We have to do what we can to secure it, which doesn't preclude the state being the solution. It just means we need to do more. But I know the Rav saw it well enough to know the Rav did not think the state was the solution. The Rav rejected any notion that there's a solution or an explanation of the Holocaust, which we've discussed before. This chapter, to this state, the state is still in a condition of crisis and danger for its future. Well, I witness the rising star of the iniquitous and to the corruption of international law by the Western nations out of indifference, the principle of justice and fairness. We have to go back, you know, to the time. You find two things, remarkable things. One, which the Rav is going to discuss later. One is what appears on the surface to be a remarkable coincidence, that after the Second World War, the connections between the Democratic West and Communist Russia quickly moved into the Cold War, right? Even though they were allies against the Nazis. But when it came to the UN resolutions, right, somehow at that moment, both America and Russia voted for partition, and both of them immediately recognized the State of Israel, even though they didn't seem to agree on virtually anything, like miraculous. But that moment didn't last, right? It didn't last because the Arabs had oil, and Israel didn't have oil. We had natural gas many, many years later, but didn't have oil. And the sympathy for Israel disintegrated. In 1956, prior to when the Rav gave the talk, was the capture of the Sinai by Israel, working together with the British and the French, and with the United States, that made Israel give the Sinai back. So the relationship that we take for granted between Israel and America, and I don't want to get into all the questions about how complicated that relationship is today, was certainly not clear in 1956, right? America's support for Israel was certainly limited. Israel it was American government, it was President Eisenhower that forced Israel to give the territory back and to leave the Sinai. So all try to carry with us enemies and balance great before them, etc. Okay. All right. Okay, and then I'm going to skip a little bit. All right. When the desire, God does not, as we emphasized above, God does not answer this question, and it's not answered. Remains hidden beyond the realm of logic, but we accept God, right? All right, we have to respond halachically. What obligation accrues to the suffering result of his suffering? Right, the halachic response is that we have to do something halachically. Do something halachically always means we do a mitzvah, we do something, right? We have to do something as a response to our suffering, right? No metaphysical thing, it's lo b'shamayim he, which I'm not even going to go into how he's using this, because there are goes a lot of different ways. All right. He didn't tell that without the implication, of course, in telos, we should complete solution. It's only if we don't try to explain it. That's a correct episode, but in practice, it demands of the sufferer courage and spiritual discipline. He must gird himself with extraordinary strength, make a detached assessment of the world, examine its past, look into the future with complete honesty. It says it's very difficult, because the person has just suffered, and now we're telling him that he has to examine himself. Right? He should want sympathy. He just suffered, and we haven't been able to explain why he's suffering, and we're asking of him, on the contrary, to examine his actions and to change. Right? This person has put a lot of reflection with spiritual fortitude and pure objectivity. His reflection bursts through to us from both the present and the past. Now he shifts here to say that what happens when something positive occurs. Remember, he's going to be talking, he had shifted from focus on the Holocaust to be focusing on what are the implications of our having a state of Israel. What does that require of us? Right? What should be our responses? Right? Kodo dido fake. Later chapter he's going to talk about six knocks, specific things, but he's building up to this. So he says if God does something miracle to us, then we have to respond properly. Right? Woe would be to the beneficiary of a miracle does not recognize it for what it is. And whose ear is deaf, he echoes the imperative, the rise of the meta-historic event. Peter, the one who benefits the miracles of the Master of the Universe, but the spark of faith is not kindled in him, and his conscience is not stirred by the slightest single event. Right? And he quotes a famous Gemara, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make Hizkiyahu the Melech HaMashiach after the Assyrians had conquered almost all of Israel, were about to conquer Yerushalayim, and miraculously they were killed, they died, and he was saved. It's all in Yeshayahu and in Malachim. But as the Gemara says, what happened? He was Mechazkel Mashiach, and Sancheirim Gog, but the God just said to him, for whom you wrote all these miracles that you not sing in praise before you, shall you make him Mashiach? Because he didn't respond properly. Right? Missed the moment. Right? And he didn't respond appropriately, and he lost the opportunity to be Mashiach. By the way, this is the only place in the Kodesh Dofek where the Rav talks about Mashiach. The Rav never talks about Israel in messianic terms. Especially the whole notion of a messianic process is a term that's foreign to the way the Rav thinks. The Mashiach is meant to be a person who is Mashiach, not a process. Right? The Rav discusses this in a rather not well-known little piece, which appears in the end of the volume called Besod HaYochid VaYichud. At the very back, he was interviewed for an Israeli newspaper by Eli Wiesel, who was at that point was a correspondent for the Idiot, and he was very unhappy with the way it was described. And his proof that he wasn't understood properly is because the term Mashiachiyut was written in the article, and the Rav says it's not part of his vocabulary. Right? What that means in terms of Reshit Tzmichat Gula Seinu, we'll leave for another time. So you have to respond in time. And the Rav builds this into the notion how everything in Halacha, time is always imperative. If there's man tefillah, then you have to daven the right time. If there's man kriyashma, and if someone misses it by 1 minute, they don't get the mitzvah kriyashma, right? Maybe you should say it anyway, you'll get some schach. But time is a determining factor, which means that delaying and not doing something at the right time has serious consequences. You don't have forever. You have to respond to it. And he does this to contrast Shaul and David. The Gemara discusses this as well. We know that Shaul did a chet and David did a chet. Maybe he did it more than one, but we'll focus on one. Right? Shaul was told when he fought against Amalek to kill everyone, and he saved the king. He saved Agag. And when Shmuel asked him, why did you save Agag? So his answer was, the people, right? The people did it. The people wanted it. Why did they destroy the stone? The people wanted to be korbanot. He blamed others. And only later was he able to did he take responsibility. And in the chet of David in Bathsheba, and I won't deal with the Gemara, says maybe it wasn't the chet, it was the chet, we'll follow the Navi. In the Navi, it's clear it's a chet. Right? Thus, the Navi says, gives him the image of the rich man, and the poor man, and the sheep. And what does David say? I'm guilty. He doesn't delay, he accepts responsibility. And that distinction between someone who takes responsibility for his actions, even his sins, and that one who tries to come up with excuses and delays it, is understood as the reason why David retains the kingdom and for all generations and shows it. Right? That's the key element. Do you respond accept responsibility. What the rub is stressing is, did you accept responsibility in part? Not just did you accept responsibility. Did you first try to get out of it, and then later say, okay, then I'm responsible? Or did you immediately take responsibility, the importance being on the time element, right? David did not miss the opportunity, immediately confessed his sin. Shaul tarried a bit, and for this delay, kinship was wrested from him. Okay. Then he goes from this, and he talks about Shaul did take responsibility, but it was too late. Right? He missed the right proper moment, and time counts. You have to do it the right time. Now he talks about Shir HaShirim, and this is the build-up for everything that's going to come. Right? What is the essence of the story of Shir HaShirim? It's not the description of paradoxical and tragic hesitation, the part of the love-intoxicated, anxiety-stricken lover, when the opportunity couched in majestic awe presented itself. What is it if not the deferral of a great sublime opportunity pregnant with the possibility of which she dreamed, for which she had fought, for which she had sought, she had searched with the fervor of soul, right? She's looking for a lover again and again. And when he comes, right, she can't find him when he finally comes and knocks on the door, she hesitates. And by the time she gets up, he's gone, right? The hesitation is the problem, right? And he's interpreting Shir HaShirim, of course, as the beloved referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? The Dod is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for this interpretation, right? He waited, and she's lazy, she's not ready to do it, right? He waits, she finally gets up. Too late, right? Too late. So now, okay, we get to the essence of the book, all right? The essence of the book. The essence of the book is that if the suffering gives us a message that we have to change, the emergence of the state of Israel, right, and all the dangers that face the state in its early years create both the opportunity and the responsibility to respond on time, the right time, to what we're supposed to learn from it. Right? We learn from the suffering to respond, and we also have to learn from the miracle, right, to respond. Now I'm going to step back for a second to point out something important. There's a whole school of thought, right, that we talk about the famous words of Shimon Peres, the timeless Torah. The Torah is the same. It doesn't matter what happens in the world. Hashem gave us the Torah. The Torah tells us what our responsibilities and obligations are, and that's true whatever happens in the world. And the only thing we know, there used to be Nevi'im, and Nevi'im could tell us, you know, Nevi'im would give us a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I won't get into different interpretations of what the Navi does bring and what the Navi can't do, but the Navi gives us the word of Hashem, right? Interprets the reality for us. We don't have Nevi'im anymore. So one extreme is to say, it doesn't matter what happens in the world. Our obligation remains exactly the same. The Torah is the same Torah. Whatever happens in the world, time is Torah, right? There's another extreme. You know, if you follow anything from Israel in the last week, you may have known of the comment of Shmuel Eliyahu, who responded to the earthquake in Turkey and Syria by saying, oh, Turks, the Syrians, they're anti-Israel, God's punishing them. Right? And, of course, there was a great deal of opposition. So how do you know what, you know, punishing? So how did you explain, you know, so you can never explain the Holocaust that God was punishing the Jews, the earthquake that took place 200 years ago in Tzfat, it was the Jews' fault. My semi-cynical comment is since the fault which caused the earthquake goes through Iran as well as Turkey, so if we assume that God is punishing those who oppose Israel or oppose the Jews, he missed it, right? An omniscient God didn't know the difference between making the earthquake in Iran, and he made it in Turkey instead. I find it hard to accept such a notion. All right. But there's another view in between the two. Not that we know to interpret every single historical event and see what God is telling us in everything, but that there are occasions where God speaks through history, right? When there's things that are so significant that they actually are saying something to us. And that after 2,000 years, we have a state of Israel, and we didn't have it for 2,000 years, that has to be tell us something, right? It can't be just happen now. Funny thing, right? God is speaking to us through history, right? Not in the sense every time any event occurs, I can explain what God is doing, but there are certain things, certainly if they affect us, not that we're interpreting what God does to other people, but if they affect us, the Jewish people, it's a message to us, right? Just like our suffering is a message to us, so the miracle is a message to us. And we have to figure out how to appropriately respond. Now, part of the response that we're going to come up with, I'm about to end, I know the clock is even more off than it usually is. Part of the response is going to be to know what we failed to do during the Holocaust and not make the mistake again. Now, one can argue how much could have been done or not done, but the fact of the matter is that the Jews of the world, let's not talk about the outside world, the Jews of the world didn't fully appreciate what was going on and did not respond accordingly. Alright? If that was a mistake, then the miracle gives the opportunity to not undo the mistake, but not repeat the mistake. Right? And this time, we'll get it right. This time, and this refers to not only the Jews who are in Israel, but the Jews everywhere else in the world as well. And I'm going to shock you by ending on time.